From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And let's go straight to Iowa, where the first contest of the presidential campaign gets underway tonight. The Iowa caucuses will set the stage for the rest of the primary season, and the Democrat who wins will get a big boost going into New Hampshire primaries next week. NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne joins us now from Des Moines. And Don, some candidates have been campaigning in Iowa for more than a year now in anticipation of tonight's caucuses. What does the final push look like?
Well, it's been fascinating to watch when you talk to voters, especially in large part because of how different it feels from caucuses from years past. First, there is such a large field. Some have been here for more than a year. Some have campaigned here for a long time and dropped out already. So the field has shrunk a bit in the past month or two, but it's still big, and there are lots of top-tier candidates, you know?
Yeah,
Biden,
what if folks—
Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg,
yes,
Klobuchar. So that makes it different. But also, can I play the voice of one voter for you that I think really does capture this? I mean, there is more of a trying to game out the system and what's going to happen in the states after Iowa. This is from a Buttigieg event in Waterloo over the weekend. They pronounce it Waterloo. Her name is Laura Sniffen. She's retired from John Deere. I just asked her the simple question, who she's caucusing for.
I'm more or less just kind of keeping an open mind. So I've seen Amy and I've seen Pete a couple times, and I have not made it to Biden, but my husband has.
And she says she might not make up her mind until she shows up in the caucus site. And the best thing about that answer to me is how long she pauses as she's answering it. She takes deep breaths. She's really, really still trying to sort it out.
That's so interesting. You know, there's been a lot of polling and reporting we've been seeing on Democratic voters in Iowa who are more focused on beating Trump, even if that means not voting for the candidate they like best on policy issues. Did you hear that in your conversation with caucus goers?
Absolutely. And that's something else that makes this a very different year. A voter after voter will tell you who can win. That's who I want. Who can win? Normally in Iowa, they'll look at the field and they say, oh, I agree with candidate X. So they get on board and they show up to caucus and you see how it all plays out. But this time, over and over and over, people say, we got to beat Trump. We got to beat Trump. We got to deny him a second term. Let's meet two more voters. These guys were both at that same Buttigieg event. The first voice you hear is a college professor and a brand new citizen, Omaru Baldy. He's confident Trump will lose. But the guy right next to him, they were seated side by side, Christopher Mertz, he runs the jazz department at the University of Northern Iowa. He's way less certain. So give a listen to them both. First, Mr. Baldy, the new citizen.
You're optimistic Trump will lose this.
Yes, I am. Positive.
Are you so optimistic?
Not as optimistic. I wish I could say that I was. And I'm going to borrow some of your optimism, if I may, because I need it.
And I might add, I thought they were friends. They had never met before the rally, but they seemed to strike up a nice acquaintance with one another, which happens a lot at these places.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about something else. There was this big news over the weekend that the Des Moines Register said it would not release a poll that comes out every year just before the caucuses because there was concern that Pete Buttigieg's name had been left out in at least one survey. How helpful would that poll have been for, say, a front runner if it had come out?
You know, it probably would have meant more for all of us obsessives who watch this stuff.
Yeah.
It's nice to have one final snapshot of where the voters appear to be. But I don't think it really affects voters themselves much at all. And I don't know that it brings people to the front runner. What would have been really interesting is if it had told us how many people are still undecided, because we feel like that number is really large this year. That would be nice to know going into tonight. But hey, you know, caucus night's here, so let's just count the votes.
Yeah, one last question for you. Who needs to do well in Iowa in order to move on to New Hampshire?
Well, I think everybody in the top tier needs to do, you know, something that they can call a solid performance. And, yep. and maybe a better way to put it is nobody can afford to tank. But especially Amy Klobuchar coming from Minnesota, right next door to Iowa, playing up her Midwestern roots, she needs to finish really well because the argument then becomes, well, if she can't win here, where can she win? Mm-hmm. But Buttigieg and Biden both appear ready to move on. Either way, Sanders and Warren are basically going home to New England for the next stop. So they'll be there either way. But there are really a million ways to handicap all this. So we'll be just watching it very closely.
Thanks so much. That's NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne in Des Moines. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's go from Iowa to Washington, where the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump is in its final days after Democrats failed to get enough votes on Friday to allow for witnesses or evidence. Today, each side is presenting closing arguments. Wednesday, Republicans are likely to acquit the president, even though many say his actions were wrong. So is this the end? NPR's Tim Mak covers national security and politics for NPR. He's been on Capitol Hill. He's still there. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And first, the Monday reaction to what happened in this trial over the weekend. Republican Senator Joni Ernst told CNN's Jake Tapper that the president asking Ukraine to investigate a political rival in exchange for military aid was not what she would have done.
Why wouldn't you have done it? Because it was wrong? Because it was inappropriate?
I think, generally speaking, going after corruption would be the right thing to do.
No, but going after the Bidens.
He did it maybe in the wrong manner.
And Senator Lamar Alexander was stronger. He said Democrats made their case. The president was wrong. But Alexander said it would pour gasoline on the culture wars to remove him. Lawyer Alan Dershowitz said also the president did it. It was wrong. What are you hearing? How are Republicans navigating that move from it didn't happen to it did?
Well, this has been something that's evolved throughout the course of this entire impeachment inquiry, let alone the impeachment trial. There have always been pools of Republicans who have been open to saying that the president did something wrong. And that looking at the facts, the president committed some misconduct. There's been folks like Senator Ernst who have been willing to very lightly touch on the topic and say, oh, well, I would not have done what the president is accused of doing. But you'll notice that Senator Ernst doesn't quite come out and say that it was wrong or that it was immoral or that it was unethical to do what the president is accused of doing in Ukraine. And then, of course, there's this these allies of the president's who are still very close to him. I'm thinking about Senator Lindsey Graham, for example, who have said that the president's call was essentially perfect.
Well, what about, Tim, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what about the new stuff that is coming out? I mean, on Friday night, the Justice Department revealed it had 24 emails that could show the president's thinking on Ukraine. On Friday, we watched during the trial as Adam Schiff looked directly at Trump lawyer Pat Cipollone and talked about the new New York Times report that John Bolton's unpublished manuscript describes a meeting where the president told Bolton to pressure Ukraine for this information about Democrats. And Cipollone was in that meeting. So looking ahead, is there thinking that Cipollone will face repercussions for not recusing himself?
Well, there's a sense that that this investigation into what Democrats have called a scheme, this scheme around Ukraine, that investigation will not conclude with the ending of this trial, as if we expect the president is acquitted on Wednesday. The House still remains controlled by Democrats, and they continue to have the ability to investigate and issue subpoenas. And it is quite possible that House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff may pursue this, may pursue a subpoena of John Bolton, may pursue a copy of Mr. Bolton's manuscript, which is now undergoing a security review. There are a lot of unanswered questions in the eyes of Democrats, and they may want to continue to look at those. So the investigation could continue.
Well, but Senator Lindsey Graham told Fox News he may try to speak with the whistleblower. He may subpoena him. We mentioned Senator Joni Ernst. She told Bloomberg News that if Joe Biden is elected, Republicans could immediately push to impeach him. I mean, just it feels as if if you do that, we'll do this.
Right. Well, there is an effort gearing up in the Senate, as you mentioned, to perhaps even hear from Hunter Biden and bring Hunter Biden before a Senate committee to answer questions. So there's a real sense on Capitol Hill that this doesn't end with the trial. This is perhaps just one act in a series of acts, and that there are a lot of unanswered questions that folks on both sides of the aisle have, and that there's, like you kind of hint at, there's some sort of unsettled scores.
Yeah, definitely. Meanwhile, we just have a few seconds to go here, but what's the tone today in the closing arguments?
Well, there's a sense of resignation among both sides that that this is a almost foregone conclusion, right? Yeah. We haven't seen large numbers of Republicans come out against the president. So, and you know, the bar is so high for conviction and removal. 67 senators need to come out and say that the president was guilty of the articles of impeachment. We haven't seen anything close to that. We may see a very party line vote when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
So right now. We're going through some of these closing arguments and expect a vote on Wednesday for acquittal.
NPR's Tim Mak covers national security and politics for NPR. Tim, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
And we've talked here about how the low unemployment rate, combined with Americans being less willing to relocate, has led to employers sweetening the pot for prospective white-collar workers, throwing in signing bonuses, for instance. But did you know there are 500,000 factory jobs unfilled? According to the Department of Labor, that's the most in nearly two decades. And now skilled factory workers are getting some perks as well. Austin Hufford wrote about this for The Wall Street Journal. He's in Chicago. Austin, what are some of the jobs and what are some of the perks?
Well, it seems like the one that's becoming more and more common is just paying for relocation, whether you're a welder, whether you know how to program a machine, or whether you're even just a normal laborer. Some factories are increasingly offering to move you across the country and give you a couple $1,000s just to begin working.
We should say that some of these workers do become white-collar workers. Some of these are management jobs. You profile a young man who used to work in a bike shop and got $2,000 to move from Salt Lake City to somewhere near Columbus. And he bought some collared shirts with the money that he got.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, this guy helps run IT equipment in a factory in Columbus, Nebraska, actually.
Yeah.
You know, he basically said that he was told from a friend of a friend that there was an opening available, and the $2,000 was enough to kind of get him to put his stuff in his car and buy some extra shirts, as he said.
What are some other companies? Just tick them off.
Well, Raytheon and Caterpillar, Lockheed Martin. You know, and even much smaller companies, like a maker of garbage trucks, a maker of parts for the car industry. You know, it kind of seems like, it, depending on where they are, it seems like it's becoming increasingly sort of what they need to do to fill their backlogs.
You know, 500,000 jobs, even as we have this low unemployment and little wage growth. Is that one of the reasons that people haven't been moving? It's hard to move if you're not going to get more money.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that a lot of economists are kind of scratching their heads about, trying to figure out why is the moving rate so low? I mean, basically, it's at the lowest rate since they started tracking the metric in the 40s.
Yeah.
And whether that means that the opportunities aren't available or something else is stopping them from moving, it's definitely not a particularly good sign.
Well, you pointed GH Tool and Mold, which is an auto industry supplier. They've increased their starting wage to around $18 an hour from $15 a few years ago. They are also paying moving expenses. They post notices on a Facebook group called Leaving Illinois to get workers from a state that is, you know, depopulating, to try to entice people to move. This seems like a good time for factory workers in this way.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems that way. I mean, I thought it's interesting how over the course of 2019, wage growth has actually ticked up. And so in December, wages for manufacturing workers grew at 3%, which is actually higher than for the rest of the economy. And so maybe we're starting to see maybe somewhat of a shift towards some of these factory jobs, which is a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing because the industry needs it.
Right. But it's important to remember, though, is that a lot of these factory jobs are not the jobs of old. You know, they're skilled. They require some sort of education, maybe not a four-year college, but definitely something, some sort of technical degree, perhaps.
Right.
And so they aren't just like necessarily just a day laborer.
And this is one of the problems that is it's happening in manufacturing right now. They have a shortage of skilled laborers.
Yes, exactly. And that's why there's so many open jobs. And that's why they're having to offer these relocation benefits because, you know, you can't really work remote at a factory.
Yeah. Austin Hufford, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, will link you to his article that lists these companies at hereandnow.org. Austin, thank you.
Thanks.
The Catholic Church is still struggling to contain the damage from the widespread clergy sex abuse scandal that first rocked the institution nearly two decades ago. New cases are still emerging. Just last week, a former Dallas priest was arrested in Missouri, accused of sexually assaulting a young child decades ago. Dallas police say the priest admitted to abusing dozens of children in the 1980s. In recent years, the Catholic Church has entered into agreements with several states to establish funds to pay reparations to the victims, but those funds come with some built-in limitations, and many people who were abused by priests as children still haven't received a dime. Colorado Public Radio's Andrew Kenny has one of their stories. Now, this warning, it's hard to hear. It includes descriptions of sexual abuse that some people will find troubling.
Pat Wilcox didn't know what to expect when her younger brother asked to move in 4 years ago. She knew he was having a hard time in Kansas, but he seemed like a different person when he arrived in Greeley in a beat-up truck.
He had his clothes in the back, the jeans. I remember they'd been rained on.
She had to throw most of his stuff away.
We couldn't get the mold off of him.
Her brother is in his 50s. His name is Terry Shippers, but to their big family, he's Shug.
You know, he was number seven, and Dad said he was his little sugar.
After moving to Colorado, Shippers was drinking heavily. His marriage was over. He seemed like a shell of himself. After another of his benders, a thought struck Pat.
It's just not alcoholism. I said, were you sexually abused? And he looked at me and he said, as a matter of fact, I was.
That day, Shug Shippers joined scores of Coloradans who've come forward with allegations of abuse by Catholic clergymen. Shippers says he met his abuser, Julian Haas, in his Kansas hometown during middle school.
You know, he was a nice guy, you know, funny, you know, liked to be around, you know, young boys, and I really enjoyed his company at that time.
Haas was a friar, and he recruited Shippers for the nearby prep school where he worked. It was run by a Catholic religious order, the Capuchins. Early on, Haas started paying special attention to Shippers. After 10 p.m. prayers, he would take the boy to the pool and to the canteen for candy.
So it was kind of a, I thought it was a treat, you know, to get to stay up later than everybody else and then get to go swimming. And that's when it, you know, it started.
Shippers says the abuse began as fondling and escalated to rape. At least seven people have come forward in recent years to allege Haas abused them in the 70s, according to the local district attorney. Shippers says the abuse ended when he confronted the friar after a few months. For decades afterward, he buried it.
You know, it wasn't easy. But I just, you know, for some reason, just kept it in and tried to, you know, move on with life.
Shippers was a star athlete in school and later the manager of a grain mill. He married his college sweetheart, Jackie Shippers.
He knew how to make everybody feel happy, feel welcome. It seemed like, you know, he's always very genuine and very full of life.
It can take decades for abuse-related problems to surface, according to Ann Hagen-Webb, a psychologist and an abuse survivor herself.
There's an awful lot of people who outwardly look very successful, look like things are just fine, and they don't sleep at night, or they are hypervigilant.
Jackie Shippers says Shug started to spiral in middle age. He lost jobs, argued with his kids, drank, until Jackie couldn't take it anymore, and she ended the marriage. When Shippers' sister Pat learned about the allegation, she wanted to tell the Capuchins. Shippers agreed.
You know, I got mixed emotions, but all in all, I thought it needed to be told, and so I told it.
The Capuchin's Mid-America province recently commissioned a review of the organization's files. It found credible allegations involving 13 clergymen, including Haas. Representatives visited Shippers, took down his story, and made an offer. Free therapy. He went to 8 appointments.
You know, just to me, kept bringing up old memories that I'm trying to forget.
Shippers is still trying to rebuild his life. For now, his family is angrier than he is.
And this priest, I mean, he ruined my family. He ruined that man. And the Catholic Church, they want to just kind of sweep it under the rug, too.
Like many others, his allegations are probably too old for a lawsuit. And Julian Haas has never been charged with a crime. He lives under voluntary house arrest at a Capuchin property in Colorado. The Catholic Church in Colorado has agreed to pay reparations to some survivors. The initial payments have averaged about $8,000. But the offer excludes those abused by religious order members like the Capuchins or out-of-state allegations like Shippers. The distinction makes Shippers' ex-wife Jackie furious.
How can that be separate? How can that be different? The crime was committed. The act was done.
She wants a response that isn't based on diocese or state boundaries. A representative for the Denver Archdiocese says the church is collectively going above and beyond what any other institution is doing. A Capuchin province representative said that it offers assistance, such as therapy, based on the facts of each case. Meanwhile, the Shippers family is wrestling with what happened. For Jackie, it's what was lost.
We would be together, and we would be doing our dreams that we had.
Shippers' sister Pat prays for guidance.
Because I was surprised at the visceral hate I had towards the individual that had raped my brother.
And for Shug Shippers, it's the unanswered question.
Why he did it, I guess, is kind of the question I have. I mean, I think I kind of know now, but it's, you know, to do what he did is just wasn't right.
It took decades for Shug Shippers to tell his story. He's still waiting to heal. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Kenny.
And last week, the investigative news site ProPublica released a database of 6,000 Catholic priests who've been credibly accused of sexual abuse or misconduct. The church released those names after a scathing 800-page report in 2018 from a grand jury in Pennsylvania detailing widespread abuse of more than 1,000 children over years. We'll link you to the database at hereandnow.org. As public health and infectious disease experts work to stave off the spread of the new coronavirus, economists are starting to look at its potential economic impact. In China today, stocks recorded their worst day in years, and economists worry that the longer it takes to contain the outbreak, the worse the financial consequences will be in China and abroad. Jill Schlesinger is the host of Jill on Money, a financial analyst at CBS, and she's writing about all this on her blog. We'll link you. Jill, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So start by telling us about these short-term consequences. What are you seeing in China?
Well, obviously, there is a huge impact when you are shutting down retail locations. And people, the consumers in China, are, whether quarantined or not, not going out and shopping. Couldn't have happened at a worse time also. Remember, this was the Lunar New Year celebration, the Year of the Rat. And this is a time, think of it almost like a holiday season in China. And imagine if we had something like this during our holidays, how we might pull back and kind of retreat to our families. So I think what we're likely to see is, at the very least, a short-term impact in the first quarter for Chinese growth, probably to see an annualized pace of about 5% in China.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, elsewhere in the program, we spoke to an American student in a province, not even in the city of Wuhan, where this outbreak started, and he said it's desolate. You know, the lunar, decorations are falling off of closed restaurants. It's really kind of sad. But what do you think this means for China's trading partners, the U.S.? We have the car industry.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, actually, when we look at Chinese growth, we were already worried it was slowing down. So we were at, 6.6% annualized in 2018, down to 6.1% in 2019. And I should say a lot of analysts and economists don't exactly believe that these are the correct numbers. But let's focus on the direction, down. And when you look at what would happen if the Chinese economy were to sputter at this point, we know that trading partners in Asia or in Europe, Germany's a big partner, or in Brazil, Brazil, even the U.S., we are seeing already the impact. We know that companies across lots of different industries have enforced travel bans. They're shutting their manufacturing facilities. They're rerouting their supply chains. And certainly lots of retailers closing stores in the affected areas.
Well, there have been flight cancellations. You know, not many people want to fly to have meetings there. And you mentioned its impact in the U.S. On Friday, the Dow fell 600 points. That's been said to be related to the virus.
Yeah, I think that the real concern is the unknown. And when we don't know things, that's when investors start to get a little bit nuts. And, you know, we're all like that when we look at our retirement accounts. We hear a headline and we want to do something. Now, that said, as you noted in the opening, the Shanghai index was down 8%, but it had been closed since January 23rd, a lot of pent-up selling. Here in the United States, stocks opened higher, but I think there continues to be a worry that the unknown is really spooky for investors, and it's hard to make a big decision to invest in a company, or if you're a company, to invest in something big going forward without understanding the scope of how this virus could spread and impact all of us.
It's so interesting. Health officials are having the same dilemma. They know it'll be a pandemic, it'll be around the world, but they just don't know how bad it will be, and investors and economists obviously watching warily as well. Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money, and we'll link you again to her blogs. Jill, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The death toll inside of Mississippi's prisons has now climbed to 15 since the end of December. Most of those deaths have occurred at Parchman, a prison with a long history of violence and squalid conditions. Mississippi's new Republican governor, Tate Reeves, recently shut down a notoriously violent unit inside of Parchman, and Mississippi lawmakers are introducing legislation to address the problem. But some say it's a little too late. Jerry Mitchell is the founder of the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. He has reported extensively on conditions dating back to 2013. And Jerry, you were at the Clarion Ledger back then, and it was a phone call from an inmate that prompted your investigation. What did that inmate tell you?
Well, unlike other inmates I kind of had gotten letters from and different things like this, he started detailing for me the corruption that was going on inside that prison. He was talking about correctional officers opening doors so that certain inmates could be beaten, even killed. And what happens is these prisons in Mississippi, they're so short-staffed. Like the vacancy rate in Mississippi is about 50%.
Mississippi also pays its prison guards the lowest rate in the country. I'm reading here that an entry-level guard makes $26,000 a year. As you note, that if a guard has a family, they would actually be eligible for food stamps. So I could see why this is an argument as to why it's a tough job to recruit for. Can you talk a little bit about how this may have contributed to some of these recent inmate suicides and killings that we're seeing?
Yes. Well, for example, on the suicide part of the equation, all but I think one of these suicides has taken place in solitary confinement. And prison experts tell you if you leave someone in solitary confinement, you need to check on them regularly. And that's the other thing that's happening with the lack of correctional officers. They're not checking on inmates. They're required under, you know, their own rules and regulations to do that. I think they check like 10 times a day or something like that, or more than that even. So anyway, so people are hanging themselves there, and then the other part of it with the murders is just you know, it's this violence, you know, because if you have the inmates in charge, the gang's essentially the most powerful, and so they kind of dominate, and so their rules go, and if they decide somebody needs to be killed because for whatever reason they owe money or whatever the situation is, they can carry it out without, and sometimes appear to be aided by guards and carrying them out. I know that one of the ones up at Parchman, there's video you can see, and the inmates actually cheering cheering the other inmate on to kill the inmate.
Oh my gosh.
And nobody around.
Officials knew they had a problem on their hands. Corrections Commissioner Policia Hall, who resigned earlier this month, repeatedly asked the state legislature for more money to hire guards. How did lawmakers respond to her?
They basically ignored her request and you know, said that, you know, they didn't have the money, essentially. That was kind of their answer to her. Hmm. You know, she put this out to them. She told them, I was there, I heard it myself, and nothing. And this go-round, they're asking, the Department of Corrections has asked for $71 million. The Legislative Committee, Joint Legislative Budget Committee, is actually recommending a cut. So this is what's happening, unfortunately, there are these cries, but then nothing happens. And basically the answer is, well, we had budget shortfalls, and they also had these corporate tax cuts as well. And it was the last priority. So, yeah, they just continued to whack away at the funding.
Jerry Mitchell, founder of the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting, talking to us about Mississippi's underfunded prisons, where a recent spate of killings and suicides have prompted the governor to shut one long troubled unit down. Jerry, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The European Union is hoping to set in law a zero emissions target by 2050 for all EU nations this year. Member state Slovenia recently became the latest country to declare a goal of going carbon neutral by 2050, promising to double its supply of renewable energy in the next 10 years. Well, one model for that could be the town of Wolfhagen, Germany, a place that already gets 100% of its electricity from renewable energy sources. Manfred Schaub is a member of Wolfhagen's city parliament, and he joins us on Skype. And Manfred, your town decided to build its own power plants to help meet this goal of becoming 100% renewable. Tell us why you did that.
Yes, we chose that road because we looked for the energy we can use here local. And the biggest chance we saw was in solar energy and wind energy. Solar energy was built in the past years from private persons and also from companies and communities.
You formed a cooperative and had the city build and operate renewable power plants. You and other local officials have said that the cooperative structure is critical because it makes citizens part owners of the power plants. So they're literally invested in the success of renewable energy there. Can you talk about the importance of that type of cooperative in this whole scheme?
Yes, this cooperative is very important. For us, we decided to give any person in Wolfhagen and around the chance to build up a cooperative, which now owns 25% of our city-owned utility company. And the idea was, if the persons have financial benefits from the windmills, they will accept it easily to that they were built.
Mm-hmm. Your town has a population under 15,000. Do you think it's possible for bigger cities to do something like this?
It's possible, yes. It depends on the size of the city. We have much smaller villages who have energy cooperatives, and we have also bigger cooperatives. So it's possible at every place. You have to find the people who do this.
Yes. Wolfhagen may be 100% renewable when it comes to electricity, but there's still fossil fuel consumption and transportation and heating sectors.
Yes.
Are you all doing anything about that? Is that something that's next on the frontier?
Yes, we are doing something, but it's not so easy as it was in the field of electricity, because in the field of heating and transportation, every person himself has to do something. So we gave some money for owners of houses to invest in environmental friendly heating systems or in insulation of the houses and so on. Yeah. And this is one project. And we have also some projects in the field of mobility.
Mm-hmm. Germany has many laws to encourage the production of renewable energy. Do you think this model would work in other countries that don't have the same laws like here in the United States?
Yes. We have to look for the circumstances in every country. It's not possible to take it one-to-one, we say in Germany, to another place. What you need is the persons who do it. And this was a key factor for our success in Wolfhagen. We have a lot of persons working together from different professions, and this was one of the key factors of our success to work together.
Yes. That's Manfred Schaub, member of the City Parliament of Wolfhagen, Germany. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Tanya.
Over the past decade, federal wildlife officials say marine vessels in Alaska's waters hit whales 77 times, by far the most of any state. About three-quarters of the time, they hit endangered humpbacks, and it's not clear why those strikes keep happening. So a group of federal researchers and marine pilots teamed up to combine what scientists know about whale behavior with what marine pilots know about ships in hopes of cutting down the number of strikes. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
Most of the millions who visit Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska each year never touch dry land. They view the majestic ice sheets from the deck of a cruise ship. For those that do make landfall, a visitor center in Bartlett Cove displays a towering skeleton of a humpback whale. National Park Service scientist Scott Gendy explains she didn't die of natural causes.
Well, this is the whale that was struck in 2001 by a cruise ship that was exiting Glacier Bay, and it kind of served as a catalyst to a lot of the efforts to reduce the probability of collision between ships and whales in the park.
The whale's name was Snow. She was a pregnant humpback that park visitors had been photographing since the 1970s. Princess Cruise Lines ended up paying $750,000 to settle with the federal government after admitting the ship had been going too fast. Scott Gendy is riding along as an observer on Holland America's Nordam. He's using a spotter scope and has a walkie-talkie to talk to the bridge.
Two killer whales, 12 o'clock, about 2,000 meters.
Two killer whales, 2,000 meters.
We take a waypoint when we sight a whale. Then we write down on the data sheet that has the distance, the orientation, the behavior, and the relative bearing to the ship.
Gendy designed this program. It's been logging observations since 2006 on how whales react as these hulking ships close in. But he didn't realize how his data could translate into real-world advice until a chance meeting with the people who sail the ships. In Alaska, foreign flag ships have to hire pilots to guide them through state waters. He says the pilots told him,
"We do this all the time, and it's not just in Glacier Bay. And we'd like to work with you and develop some of these ideas because you have a good grip on the science of whale behavior, but we're the ones out there operating the ships every day."
One of those marine pilots is Larry Vose. He says it was a light bulb moment.
We said, "Look, let's work on you guys, you know, helping educate us on whale behavior and see how that applies, and we'll help to educate you on limitations of ships and so forth."
The first step, dispels some myths, like that slowing down is the most effective course of action to take when spotting a whale. It's often better to change course, but there are a lot of factors.
Just like a deer running out in front of a car, you know, you may or may not have time to react. And that action that you take has to factor in, do no further harm. You know, don't drive into a tree head on. Don't list a ship so much that you cause damage and such.
Gendy's research, coupled with the pilot's experiences at the helm, lays out what they've learned in Glacier Bay, and in some ways it could be applied in other places. That's important, as federal authorities have logged more than 180 whale strikes in U.S. waters over the past decade. And that's an undercount. Ship captains aren't legally required to report when they hit a whale. And sometimes they don't even know it happened. The dead whale can sink to the bottom, or it decomposes on a remote beach. Other times, it isn't so discreet, like in 2017, when a Princess Cruise Line ship sailed into Ketchikan Harbor with a dead humpback on its bow.
Quite frankly, I have no idea when we picked the whale up.
Eric Chamberlain is a top executive for the Carnival Group that includes Princess Cruises and Holland America Line. The strike happened at night. Nobody saw it, and it wasn't discovered until first light. He says they followed all of the procedures to avoid hitting whales and that the cruise industry is eager to improve in any way it can. For two reasons. It's the right thing to do, and it's good business.
It is of utmost importance that our use of the area, the resources of the area, is sustainable.
Larry Vose says he's still learning even after decades driving ships in Southeast Alaska. He's had some close calls.
There's just times when, for whatever reason, with nothing else going on, literally, a whale surfaces close aboard.
This group of federal researchers and independent marine pilots recently put their findings down on paper in an article published in the journal Frontiers in Marine Science. Gandhi says it's a long road ahead, but he's happy with what they've contributed so far.
If we can understand the nature of ship strikes without actually having ship strikes occur, then you can formulate management actions, or we can understand avoidance maneuvers without having a bunch of dead whales on the beach.
Look at him. There he's going to go down.
On the bow of the Holland America ship, passengers wrapped in parkas hoot and holler as a humpback whale sidles up to the ship. This is what they've come to Alaska to see. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Resnick, reporting from Glacier Bay.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.